Fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all ages and disability affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next is Between the Covers. David Damon welcomes Brendan Shimoda, an American of Japanese descent. He talks about his family being an enemy of the state during World War II in his book, The Grave on the Wall. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate, or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring artists touring nationally and internationally. Shows start this September with Jim Queskin and Meredith Axelrod. The new season continues with artists Bill Staines, Radim Zenkel, and the Honey Whiskey Trio. Then 2020 kicks off with Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, followed by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, Robin and Linda Williams, Pat Donahue, and Joni Harms. Portland Folk Music Society concerts are presented at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Is a proud co-sponsor of Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater in Portland. The second son of Bob and Rita Marley, eight-time Grammy-winning musician and producer Stephen Marley, will perform in Portland with DJ Sasha Pena, who will be opening the show. Again, that's Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater, 8 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the poet Brendan Shimoda. Shimoda is the author of 6 books of poetry, including Portuguese from Tin House and Octopus Books, The Desert from Song Cave, and Evening Oracle from Letter Machine Editions, which received the William Carlos Williams Award from the Poetry Society of America. Shimoda is also an artist who created the line drawings for the book, The Department of Posthumous Letters from Argos Books. Shimoda's writings on Japanese American incarceration have appeared in the Asian American Literary Review, Densho, Hyperallergic, The Margins, and The New Inquiry, and he's given talks on the subject at the University of Arizona, Columbia, Fairhaven College, and the International Center of Photography. He is the co-editor with Tom Donovan of To Look at the Sea is to Become What One Is, an Etel Adnan reader from Nightboat Books. And Brendan Shimoda is here today on Between the Covers to talk about his first book of nonfiction, his ancestral memoir, The Grave on the Wall, just out from City Lights. Don Miche says of The Grave on the Wall, "It is part dream, part memory, part forgetting, part identity. It is a remarkable exploration of how citizenship is forged by the brutal U.S. imperial forces through slave labor, forced detention, indiscriminate bombing, historical amnesia, and wall. If someone asked me, 'Where are you?' I would answer, 'From the grave on the wall.'" And Banu Kapil says this of The Grave on the Wall. Shimoda is a mystic writer. He puts what breaches itself, always, onto the page, so that the act of writing becomes akin to papermaking, an attention to fibers, coagulation, texture, and the water-fire mixtures that signal irreversible action or change. Does the book end? Is there a sentence that closes it? Or does it keep being written and forgotten, then written again each time the reader opens it for the first time? I have never met this writer in person, and perhaps I never will, but he has written a book that touches the bottom of my own soul. Welcome to Between the Covers, Brandon Shimoda.
Hi, nice to see you, David.
So one way into the grave on the wall, I think, is through questions raised by the ways we attempt to memorialize or represent the past, and also the ways those attempts to remember the past can be acts of erasure themselves. So given that America in particular is a place where we can't assume that everyone knows the same history or acts from the same history, particularly when it comes to history that deviates from white American history, I was hoping we could start by talking about the situation your grandfather, Midori Shimoda, was in as a child. What was going on in Japan and Hawaii and California for his parents that prompted emigration from Japan and ultimately to the United States. Mm-hmm.
So first, just thinking about what you said about histories that deviate from white American history, the history that I think about with the Japanese side of my family, as well as many other histories that have been, imagined as deviations, are actually white American history, in the sense that, so thinking about my great-grandfather who came over as a contract laborer on a pineapple plantation outside of Honolulu, that history that he was a subject of was a history being written by white America at the time to satisfy all of the kind of voracious needs and requirements of white America. But to think about it as a deviation is basically to say that's those subjects that are feeding that machine are not really part of the dominant narrative. So just to think about it that way. I think part of my initial attempt at writing this book was that I wanted to discover and understand parts about my family's history that had never been talked about. So I knew nothing. I knew very little about my grandfather's life prior to my entrance into his life. I knew nothing about my great-grandparents, nothing really about my ancestors. So the desire was to write a book that would give me the opportunity to learn some of these things. And I actually feel like in a certain way I failed in that I didn't. There's so much that I still don't know and don't understand because there's a limit to what I was able to uncover. In thinking about my great-grandfather, so my grandfather's an immigrant, but my great-grandfather came over to the United States, or he came over to Hawaii long before my grandfather did. And that's, he represents the first entrance of the Shimoda family into the United States. And also in a way, the book is, it's like opened up an occasion for me to keep studying this sort of thing, because I feel like I set out a bunch of things that are sketches that now I'm filling in the sketch through post-book research. It's, maybe I'm doing it backwards, but yeah, I think a big part of the work is to illuminate those histories and pair them with this idea of white American history, and to say white American history does not run without the history of the marginalized and the oppressed. They, in fact, are the labor that makes white American history possible and legible, right?
So the 26 voyages of 29,000 Japanese contract laborers from Japan to Hawaii in a less than 10-year period in the late 19th century that affected your family, and which the need for that contract labor coming from the Chinese Exclusion Act and from the genocide of Native peoples.
Right.
That is what you're saying is that is white history. So the Japanese emigration to Hawaii, the need for that even is ultimately coming from a white narrative.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you imagine, like, for some reason, this is the image that came to mind, Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. He is the painter. You know, everything that we're seeing in that triptych are the subjects and the objects that he uses to sort of create his vision. But he is the painter in the sense that white America has I think, given itself the status of the painter of history. But all of the figures and all of the figures that are populating that vision are the other, right?
Yeah. Well, I want you to read a really brief section about picture brides. But before you do, I know it's a complicated history, but could you at least give us a little orientation to what picture brides were, how they affected your family and and many Japanese families at the time?
Yeah.
Because as people will see as we go into this conversation, your book is very much about photography and about pictures in addition many other things.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So there's a lot of legislation and agreements between the United States and Japan, as well as different anxieties that were happening within the United States, race-based anxieties that led to the picture brides. But what they were, in fact, was there were Japanese men in the United States who were not legally permitted to marry. So they had to marry women that were in Japan. But more often than not, the two had never met each other. So they were able to become acquainted with each other through exchanging photographs of each other. The women were primarily, you know, they were teenagers for the most part. The men were, some of them were very old. They ranged. So they exchanged photographs through an intermediary, and often the photographs that the men would send back to Japan were either doctored, or photographs of them when they were much younger, or photographs of people that weren't them, in a way to sort of seduce these potential wives.
Well, and to connect this to your assertion that this is also white history,
right?
If I have the history correct, please correct me if I don't, but this story that might on its surface seem like, oh, this is the way Japanese immigrants found love or found marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the product of a deal with the president of the U.S. who wanted to segregate Japanese students in schools.
Right.
And there was a deal made allowing this picture bride phenomenon or immigration of a certain sort.
Yeah.
No segregation in schools, but a very large reduction in the number of people who came. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, so the gentleman's agreement, which I touch on very briefly in the book, was the agreement that, like you're saying, it had to do with a lot of different kind of legislative moves that ultimately resulted in a loophole, actually. I mean, picture brides were, what happened is the United States limited Japanese immigration to the United States. And one of the exceptions to that limit was, the limitation was, you could immigrate if you already had family within the United States. So by marrying, then you became family and you could immigrate.
Okay.
But it was a massive reduction in immigration. So, so you're right. I think a lot of people, when they hear about picture brides, they think, oh, that's such an interesting cultural, you know, it's an interesting element of culture. But in fact, it was motivated by racist legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear this little section on page 10.
Okay. The women were given pamphlets by immigration training societies on how to dress and bathe and walk like a Western woman, how to sit on a toilet, how to cook food that would not offend their white American neighbors. They were not, due to legislation dating back more than 100 years, permitted to become American, but they were expected to behave American. They were expected to be both exemplary and invisible. The proxy weddings in Japan were not recognized in the United States. When the young woman arrived after 3 weeks at sea, they were married a second time in mass ceremonies on the docks. A young woman is a bride, and the groom doesn't always belong to the human species. The men often looked considerably different from the men in the photographs, older, 10 to 15 years on average, less attractive, or not the men at all, brothers, friends, cousins. Between 1908 and 1920, over 10,000 Japanese picture brides immigrated to the United States. The unintended consequence of the gentleman's agreement was the first generation of American-born children of Japanese ancestry, the Japanese Americans. The ladies' agreement followed in 1921, ending the emigration of picture brides. The last passport issued to a picture bride was dated February 29. It was valid through the 1st of September.
We've been listening to Brandon Shimoda read from his latest book, The Grave on the Wall. You say that picture brides, in a sense, are marrying the photographs first, before they marry their future husbands, and before they discover the ways in which the photos are not telling the truth or mm-hmm. hiding the truth behind them. And in that regard, I was thinking of you placing yourself in the role of a picture bride in The Grave on the Wall, mm-hmm. because this book's origin begins with you confronting a photo mm-hmm. and then discovering with the more time you spend with the photo that maybe it's not telling you what you originally might think. So tell us about the origin story of, of The Grave on the Wall and why the origin story of this book centers around one specific photograph.
Yeah. It's funny because in that formulation, I would be marrying my grandfather.
Yeah.
Right. Or he would be marrying me. And I think in an earlier version of the book, I do, in a more hyperbolic kind of maybe saccharine version of the book, I did write about being my grandfather's bride.
You did?
I did, yeah. Wow. I don't know where those paragraphs went.
I mean, I felt the love. I mean, as conflicted as you are around this photograph,
right?
You do. I think you put it under your pillow at one point.
Yeah.
In the book,
right.
And there is this great magnetic attraction happening between you and this photo,
right?
From which spins out all this meditation on many other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean it. Also, the idea that, there's a sentence about the women were marrying the photographs first. And that seemed to be factually true because they were often getting married in Japan when the men were in the U.S. or in Hawaii. So they were marrying the photographs. Mm. But that, I don't know if it's, if you would share this idea that, in any relationship, we're more or less committing to an idea, or at least the potentiality, before the actual person slowly starts to reveal who they are, right? Mm. So, but yeah, the photo you're referring to is a photograph of my grandfather taken in 1943 when he was in the Department of Justice prison in Missoula, Montana. And it's a picture, well, there's several pictures, but one main picture is of him wearing a bra and a slip. And I think that's it. It's a picture that almost immediately after the moment that I first saw it, I became obsessed with and knew that I wanted to deal with in some way, and that I still am dealing with. Whether it's the photograph or all of the things that are sort of generated out of that photograph, it's the book didn't quench my mm-hmm. my desire to understand what it was that I was looking at and spending time with. Hmm.
Tell us why it's this photograph that has created this exploration and this art making.
I think part of trying to understand or trying to articulate why is manifesting in my inability to stop writing about it. I might approach an answer, but then I get thrust into another direction. So I don't really know actually why, but This is a photograph that is part of an exhibit, a very small exhibit, on the incarceration of Japanese immigrants in Fort Missoula. And it's the exhibit is in the ruins of the prison. So I went to graduate school in Missoula, Montana, and I moved there in August of 2004. And almost immediately, one of the first things I did is I went to that museum exhibition. And I write about this in the book, that I went there with the determination that I was going to encounter my grandfather. I didn't know in what form that would happen, but I felt pretty confident that I would find him there, maybe somewhat arrogantly, that he would just manifest in, you know, it's so explicitly in the sight of his own history. The museum has one of the original barracks where the men lived, and they've converted just a really small part of that into a pretty small exhibition that is just a small room that has, you know, maybe 30 photographs, most of them fairly straightforward depictions of incarceration, men eating food, men standing in line, barbed wire fence, guard tower, all of those kind of like fairly stereotypical markers of that history. And then towards the end of that arrangement of 30 photographs is 3 photographs of a man dressed as a woman. There's many things that are remarkable about that. One is that there is no caption. So many of the other photographs have captions, but then you arrive at these photographs of a man dressed as a woman, and there's no explanation as to what is taking place. You can kind of piece together that it's a performance, part of a performance. When I saw those photographs, I froze, and I think all the blood rushed to the bottom of my toes, because the man in the photographs was my grandfather, and he was roughly the same age I was when I saw them. And I mean, I think I still exist in that state of shock, even though I don't necessarily know what the nature of that shock was or continues to be. But I felt like I was looking into a very perverse and very revelatory mirror. And what I saw was the beginning of a much deeper and darker truth about incarceration from which I had been withheld within my own family, because it was a history and a subject that was never discussed. So I felt like I was I had been permitted this glimpse into something more truthful, that it was almost like it was threatening to hold me up against that history in a way that I wasn't prepared for. So it's a beautiful photograph. I mean, my grandfather was a beautiful man, and he has a huge smile on his face, and he's an enemy alien incarcerated by the government of the country into which he's trying to create a life for himself.
Well, I'd like you to read the section about the first encounter with the photo, particularly because also the smile, I think, takes on different meanings as you spend time with the photo itself. But before you do, can you speak to why you call this photo the grave on the wall? Why you see it as a grave?
Sure.
Ultimately.
So we cremated my grandfather and scattered his ashes in Death Valley in 1996. And we scattered his ashes in a location that's actually very difficult to find. So we've returned a few times since then and haven't been able to find the exact location because it's the desert. And it has a powerful genius for sort of evading its visitors in ways that are obviously terrible and tragic. And but in this situation, he doesn't really have a grave. There's not, or at least my original thought as I was starting to, when I was in the early years of mourning my grandfather's death, is that there was no place that I could really go to be with him. So when I discovered these photographs hanging on the wall in the ruins of the prison, I felt like I was being offered a place to visit him. So that became kind of the ritual grave. That became the grave where I could go. And because I lived nearby, I could go as much as I wanted to spend time with him. But I think what started to complicate that idea over time is that these photographs are very specific, right? They're expressing a moment and maybe several moments in which his life was arrested. So I sort of feel like a grave proliferates out of any moment in which our lives are arrested. Mm-hmm. I write in the book, I think, a moment of arrest or a moment of a part of us having broken away, so that we actually like have an entire wake of graves behind the present moment. I think it's all feeding into this idea that as we live our lives, even if we're living lives that are relatively uncontested, there are parts of us that are constantly being sloughed off or constantly breaking away. So I envision our lives as being a process where we're generating a wake of graves. But then if you have someone like my grandfather who was arrested, you know, by law, he was arrested. And in the process of his arrest, he had to, in a way, transform himself into maybe a more legible, acceptable version of the person he might have originally imagined himself to be. So that a part of him, a very considerable part of him, was arrested and broke away. So that's what the photograph is, a picture of that moment or that phase in his life. And then the photograph itself is a grave. So it's like going to the grave to look into a proliferation of other graves that he was generating out of his own experience. So the way I sort of feel about the photograph is that it's presenting to me a grave of mirrors, right? It goes in so many different directions at once. And maybe that's what a grave is. You know, when you go to spend time with the dead, it's a dimensionless experience, or it's an omnidimensional experience.
Well, let's hear that section.
Sure. I went to the ruins expecting to see Midori's face, but I did not think I would see Midori's face. So when I saw Midori's face, I felt sick. It was the kind of uncanny recognition that registers first as nausea. I turned away, then turned back, leaned closer, and touched him. The wall fell back. The roof of the barracks lifted off. Midori's face was brighter than daylight, and though I remember it being warm and round and full of love, I was a part of it. I remember it being gray and soft and unaccountably sad, of a sadness I could not name. I saw my father's face for the first time in the frame of incarceration. I saw my sister Kelly's face. The sun had fallen to earth, revealing its exact size and dimension. Who has the nerve to touch the sun? Midori was staring through the mirror, through the photographer, through the guards, through the mountains surrounding the valley, through the clouds washing down the faces of the mountains. I felt like I was being thrown through Midori's face into the immediacy of a history that was, until then, remote, more or less extinct. I ran across the field. The only person in the museum was the woman in the gift shop, Sharon. I told her I had just come from the barracks, that my grandfather was hanging on the wall. I described him, out of breath. She told me to wait a minute, then disappeared. She returned with a three-ring binder and an envelope. The binder contained photographs of the prisoners, mostly Italian, a few Germans, some Japanese. The Italians called Missoula Bella Vista. They were from Europe, lived in Europe. They were not immigrants. Some of them stayed in the valley after their release, so beautiful was their view. The photographs depicted the interstitial, less photogenic moments that illuminated incarceration as wasteland, arbitrary confusion. The envelope contained 5 photographs from the binder Sharon had photocopied. All 5 were of Midori. They were taken by Peter Fortune, an INS agent in Hawaii, called up to Fort Missoula, where he worked in food service and in his free time took photographs. In one of the photographs, Midori is wearing a bra and white slip, skin-toned stockings rolled down his thighs, and black shoes, and is posing alone, smiling. Midori's body and face are a map describing a territory I know, think I know, or have known, but which looks from the vantage of this graphic projection of him unfamiliar, another territory altogether. I try to locate myself. Every landmark and place name, every feature is visible, if not accessible, at once. But the cardinal directions have switched places, gone missing. I've always associated hair that stands straight up off a person's head as evidence of the restlessness of their thoughts. Midori's ears are large. When I squint, his ears move. His right leg is up on a wooden bench. His right hand is cupping his knee. His left leg is bent. The back of his left hand, pressed against his hip, covered by the waistline of the slip hanging mid-thigh, evokes restraint. 2 veins run the length of his left forearm. The vein in his right arm, corresponding to the vein on the underside of his left, is visible, originating in the terminal of his elbow, snaking to his wrist. That is where I see myself most clearly, in his veins and arms, his right arm straight, partially obscured at his bicep by his bra and chest, his left pectoral visible between his shoulder and the top of the bra. 2 eels are swimming beneath his skin. His stockings are rolled down his thighs just below the hem of the slip. The slip is tight, though soft. The waistline of his slip is folded in above his navel. The hem of his slip is a fringe of wide circles. Around each circle is a wider circle. A black line beginning at the top of his right thigh swoops at his crotch. The line tapers, disappears into whiteness. Midori's eyes are clear, almost wet with the flash of the bulb twice reflected. His eyebrows are slightly raised. It is there that I begin to sense skepticism, concern, distrust, and its corresponding lack of agency, resignation. 2 lines on his forehead form a pediment. He is smiling, but the lines around his eyes are unmoved. His upper lip is straight, unconvinced. Sometimes his smile is a wave, sometimes a wound, sometimes not entirely his. If not, to whom and how many people, entities, institutions does it belong? Midori did not know Peter Fortune, nor did he know who would see this photograph. He posed in several dimensions at once. Half naked, proud, even triumphant, he is, against a wall of thick timber, performing. But the longer I stare at his body and face, his eyes and his smile, the less convinced I become that he is actually sharing or free to share any part of himself. Who he is and what he is feeling is being sublimated, suppressed, by his outward appearance, pushed down the deep well of his throat, into his chest, but beyond the reach of his heart. When I left the museum, the barracks, the fields, I felt infused with the spirit of connection. Midori and I had been reunited, but the feeling did not last. There was no sense that Midori had been waiting for me, his grandson, anyone. Almost as soon as the body and face of incarceration were revealed, they were replaced with an unconquerable loneliness. The sky was low and tyrannically white. The mountains in the distance were suddenly very close, cliff-like and impenetrable. I called my grandmother, then my father. Their voices were soft, underwater. It was not that they did not seem interested in the photographs, but they did not ask any questions, which caused me to doubt what I had seen. It was true. The barracks, isolated and staged, manifested an alternate universe, one in which my desperation had been appeased. I had reduced the history of incarceration not only to Midori's face, but to my desire to understand.
We've been listening to Brandon Shimoda read from his latest book, The Grave on the Wall. So when we think about this photo, maybe like the picture bride photos, but where you're having an encounter that at first might seem to capture a moment, and then the more you stare at it, the more under inspection it seems to be suggesting something beneath the surface that maybe even contradicts the surface. I think about the other photos that you gravitate toward in other books of yours, which also seem to have this quality. So the cover of your previous book, The Desert, has the three figures in festive ritual clothing and decorative masks. And you might just look at this without any context and see a celebration. And it is technically a celebration. It's a celebration of the Harvest Festival, but from inside the Thule Lake concentration camp during World War II, which interned thousands of Japanese and Japanese Americans. And this same photographer, Francis Stewart, took other photos that, like the picture of your grandfather in women's clothes, seem hard to parse. And most notably, the photos of incarcerated Japanese Americans in blackface or dressed as Native Americans. And you write about your encounter with these photos in your essay, I Am an American, The Photographic Legacy of Japanese American Incarceration. And in that you say, the appearance of a young Nikkei couple in blackface in a U.S. concentration camp on land that had until the late 1800s been inhabited for thousands of years by the Modoc people articulates the dynamic in which non-white people, native, alien, slave, are manipulated as the subjects and counter-subjects of a chronic performance. The photograph illuminates a nearly subliminal moment of anti-blackness masquerading as minstrelsy, masquerading as carefree, careless, communal play-acting, masquerading as jubilation under duress, aka mass oppression. I guess I was hoping you'd speak more about chronic performance, mm-hmm. not just in relationship to these photographs, but I guess gesturing towards the chronic performance of America. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I guess, when I think of photography, for a lot of people, their first response is one that they're getting neutral documentation, mm-hmm. that they're getting objective reporting, that they're getting the moment is being captured.
Right. Do people still feel that way?
Well, I don't think people who are writing about it,
right.
about photography,
yeah.
think that way.
Right.
But I would think like an average person who right. hasn't investigated it might have a more of a bias towards that with a yeah. photograph than with a painting.
Yeah. One of the first things you said was being able to move beyond the surface of what is seen, right? So looking at a photograph and being able to move beyond or through the surface of something. But I'm not even sure people are paying attention to the surface of things, right? So I would actually correct something I wrote in that piece in which I describe this photograph, as you described, of two young Japanese American couple in blackface. So I wrote in that piece, it's a nearly subliminal moment of anti-blackness, but it's not nearly or subliminal at all. I mean, it's very much on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw that photograph in an exhibition in a museum in Tucson that had many photographs, the original WPA photographs of the camps. And then a photographer took those photographs, found the people in all those subjects, and went and photographed them now. And they're all in their 70s and 80s.
Hmm.
But within that exhibition is this blackface photograph. And it's, in terms of its surface, that's what it is. You don't have to really go beyond the surface in order to see what that is. So I'm questioning as to why I said it was subliminal. I think it's subliminal, and things are subliminal because of the viewer. And the viewer, the way they're engaging with what's there, is in a way preordained. So I think that every time there's an exhibition of photographs about Japanese American incarceration, the response is in a sense preordained. You know, as I was in this particular exhibition, I was listening, I was eavesdropping on conversations that other people were having as they were looking at the photographs. And it's the kind of language that I remember hearing from my family when I was younger about, oh, it's such a shame, and can you believe what they did? You know, all these kinds of things that don't really mean anything. And then there's a photograph of two people in blackface, and it's receiving no comment whatsoever because it doesn't fit into people's form of remembrance and memorialization.
So is that similar to the lack of a caption for your grandfather's photo? Like, there's a way in which, because it doesn't settle into that,
yeah,
that you sort of skip over
right,
commenting on it?
It defies captioning.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's the photograph that to me revealed something, a more explicit truth, a more buried, a more enshadowed, but more maybe honest and accurate and more debilitating truth of what that history was all about, you know, in terms of this kind of like the psychosis of colonization. And thinking about chronic performance, it's like thinking about the ways in which oppressed communities and populations are forced to cannibalize each other or dismember each other at the service of some dominant power, right?
That's where I wondered whether, I mean, I agree with you that it's on one level all on the surface. The anti-blackness is on the surface, but then there's the subtext of not understanding who's anti-blackness.
Right.
So, I mean, your first glance could be, oh, it's Japanese or Japanese American anti-blackness, which it may or may not be. But is it really? And can people who are incarcerated really be making free choices? And under what circumstances are they making these specific choices?
Right.
And to what ends and what compromises? Like, all of that's the part that doesn't feel like it's on the surface.
Oh, yeah.
Though maybe right, it is on the surface.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I was just thinking about how people weren't even people. Well, I can't speak for people who are looking or not looking at anything, but I imagine that it presented something so inherently uncomfortable that they couldn't even see the surface to even get to some of those considerations.
Yeah,
right?
That makes sense to me.
That it was, I guess that's what I mean. It becomes subliminal because the viewer has this certain block.
Hmm.
But right, I mean, what it unfolds, once you actually are confronting and addressing this thing, it starts to unfold pretty rapidly. It's like this accordion book that opens out and uncovers all the story behind, the many stories behind the story that's being promoted. So I'm referencing this one exhibition in Tucson, but also the exhibition in Missoula. And I do feel like against the will and the whims of the people who are putting these kinds of exhibitions together, against that is the will, the even more overpowering will of the material, that the material will begin to leak through the surface that is proposed by the maker, by the curators, etc. It will leak and it will... it's indomitable. It will start to assert its own force, and some fragments of a truth will begin to congeal. But obviously there's, you know, the viewer has a responsibility to be attentive to that.
And when you say the material exerts its own force, that's also, I'm imagining, independent of the photographer who made the material.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. 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 I mean, ideally, I mean, that photographer was commissioned by the government, like Dorothea Lange and Frances Stewart. They were commissioned by the government, so they had an obligation to do a certain kind of work. But I imagine that even those photographers knew that they were going to be capturing things that defied their commission. And it's the same with being a writer or any kind of artist. I at least hope that I'm producing things that are, I hope that I'm producing things that are defying even my wishes. You know, I can't control whether or not that's good or bad, but I think that, like, maybe a more honest reality will emerge from what I've made. I mean, that there's a limit to what, to like my agency in relation to what I've producing, I think.
Mm-hmm. One book that I thought a lot about in relationship to this book, which I know you reviewed a long time ago, but also an artist who you've been in correspondence with, is Banu Kapil's Humanimal. And in that book, where she's returning to India, where her ancestors are from, to investigate this story of girls in the 1920s who were purportedly raised by wolves and then rescued by a reverend and rehabilitated, a lot of that feels like she's having to put herself in the position of having limited documentation, mm-hmm. and not being able to parse what she does have, similar to this photograph. So she goes, and all of the documentation she has, or most of it, is from the reverend himself, and is also sort of a self-serving performance that he does for profit at mm-hmm. the expense of the girls. And she has a French film crew with her, and that French film crew themselves hire a folkloric acting troupe to reenact the girls being raised by wolves. And so there's just sort of a Russian doll setup of various attempts at representation and documentation that none of which are claiming anything absolute. And you can tell that she doesn't even think that's possible in this sense. Mm-hmm. But it almost feels like her father, which she inserts into the story as a body, is the book. And mm-hmm. and you wrote in this, in your review, something interesting to me. Banu's family emerges in the form of her father, memories of his skin, the skin on his feet, a map back, but to where, the body at once and in an instant, a sight, a wound, an unraveling atlas. And you had mentioned when you, in that reading you just did, this idea of a map with your own grandfather. And I think about the way she's using literally the flesh of her father, the scars on his body, and what do those represent when she's looking at this story of colonial violence in India, mm-hmm. And perhaps why she didn't end up, the story of why she ended up growing up in England, and, mm-hmm. which I would imagine also the question of like, why is your family in Hawaii and then California and, mm-hmm. and now here? So I was hoping maybe you could speak to this question of the body, mm-hmm. And to the missing body of your grandfather. Because in another piece you say, in the Poetry Foundation, you wrote, the first corpse I did not see was my grandfather's. His corpse is why I am here, poetry. Mm-hmm. Intuitively, I feel like there's a move that you're both making that is a kindred move, mm-hmm. and it has something to do with bodies.
I knew that when I began to take seriously the fact and the bitter responsibility of being a citizen of the United States, that I would have to confront my ancestors' struggle to become citizens of the United States. And in particular, my grandfather's struggle. And I knew that in order to understand my uncontested situation, I would have to really interrogate what he endured and how the United States and both the impossibility of becoming a citizen and then the potential of becoming a citizen in a way shaped his relationship to himself, and that he had to disfigure himself and transform himself into a certain type of legible body. It was in large part through my grandfather's experience, as well as other of my ancestors who immigrated from Japan, that I was able to understand what this country even is. So in a way that hopefully it wasn't too violent as his grandson, I sort of used his body and his life as this map that, you know, extended from Hiroshima to Death Valley. And that I really needed him, and from his experience to his skin, to be able to really understand what is this country about, and what is my relationship to the history of this place. Both personally and communally and nationally. So maybe there's some correspondence there with Humanimal, or what you described of Humanimal.
Well, is there a correspondence there with what you've just said with your own words, his corpse is why I am here, poetry?
Yeah, well, that feels even more personal. So he died in 1996, and I was 18, but he had Alzheimer's for, we'll say, 15 years. It's hard to chart exactly, which means that he had it since I was age 3. So my entire relationship with him was a relationship with a disintegrating being, a person who was in a constant state of decline, a person who was in a constant state of degeneration. I was not there when he died. I did not go to his funeral. I wasn't even there when he was dying, so I didn't see him the last 5 years of his life. This is just a speculation, but I feel like not even that a lot of what I write is about him, but that I write at all is at least in part related to the fact that I was not a participant in his dying and his death. Because my very earliest writings, including the first thing I ever published, were stories about him. Were stories of trying to recuperate even just my sense of who this person was, who had an enormous impact on me, who was someone I was very close with despite his disintegrative state. Maybe it was intuitive, maybe it was unconscious, but I felt like I wanted to reanimate him because there was something about him and his life that would teach me something about mine. Myself and my life. That's the unconscious part. But he was a figure that I felt like, he was a figure that almost instantaneously populated my writing. So when I think about his was the first corpse I did not see, that's basically a way of saying he was my first loss. You know, he was my first and maybe most primary loss. And that out of that loss generated this entire imaginative space, this inner life that has now become an outer life. And that over time, what it revealed was my relationship to the country in which I live.
Hmm. Well, I want to connect these thoughts to an ongoing interest of yours of memorials and memorialization, which we see throughout your work, books and otherwise. First, I'm just going to read a quote that I connect to this interest of yours. I don't think you're necessarily connecting it, but I'm going to make a potential one where you said, "The occasion of poetry has makes possible the dehumanization of the body through predatory grieving, the loss of one's own body, the loss of another's body, the loss of all bodies. Because if a corpse is not real, neither is the living body." So when I think about this, about the question of the corpse being real and how that reflects back on the people who are alive in relationship to it, and I think about, again, your investigation of memorialization and memorials. We can look at In the Grave on the Wall, you go looking for the cemetery of your ancestors in a town that no longer exists in Japan. You go to the commemorations of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. You go to the African burial ground in Manhattan. And in other writings, you visit the memorial stupa in the killing fields of Cambodia. And you write about the Japanese internment memorial here in Portland, Oregon. And you have a quote in one of your essays that says, "If you don't know anything about the history of a place, the rise and genocidal history of a place that is that place, if you don't know anything about the people who were killed and the people who did the killing and the people who neither killed nor did the killing but did the killing, if you don't know anything about the history that is the present moment and vice versa and the next and the bodies underneath your feet and the bodies in the air you're breathing, that is America." And when I think of that quote, which is amazing, I would initially imagine that you'd be happy about the existence of memorials, that that they would be this gesture, this counter gesture against the forgetting, this acknowledgement of history and of place, and in place, typically, not always, but often in specific places. But it feels like when we visit these memorials and commemorations with you, the predominant one is a feeling of something being hidden or avoided or prematurely closed off through the process of memorialization. Uh-huh. And so much so that when I'm with you in these different visits, the things that I still remember are not as so much the memorials, but the guy in the blue jacket with the leaf blower and someone mowing the lawn near one of the statues, or the police sweeping out the homeless of the Portland Japanese Memorial. So I was hoping, in a larger sense, you could talk about why you feel like you return to this question of memorialization and memorials, and also and particularly why you feel attracted to go to them when it does feel like there's a dissatisfaction that happens over and over in the encounter with them.
Yeah. Yeah, your questions are great. I'm really disarming. Mm. I am happy when I go to memorials.
You are?
Yeah. I'm also sad and angry and disappointed. I'm also inevitably distracted. But what I've determined is that the thing I'm distracted by is actually the memorial. I go to a memorial thinking, for example, this is a memorial for the hundreds of thousands of people who died in the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. But what happens when you get to a memorial is you, because it's in the present and because life is unfolding as it does, you start to pay attention to things that are happening in that moment. And to me, the things that are happening in that moment are the true consciousness of that memorial. Hmm. Or at least the manifestation of the memorial. And I'm happy about going and being surprised and being being shook out of my preconceived ideas of what it is that we're commemorating, right? The thing that frustrates me about memorials in general is the fact that they're attempting to articulate a history that, for the most part, has not ended. I don't think there's a single memorial I've been to that is addressing a history that's actually over, you know? And I think no memorial really addresses that fully. A question that has been really motivating for me in the past couple years is a question posed by Christina Sharp in her book In the Wake on Blackness and Being. And it is, how do we memorialize an event that is still ongoing? That's a huge question. It seems like a simple question, but it's a huge question. And I wonder how memorials themselves might answer that question. Because in my opinion, it seems like most of the events that are being memorialized, at least in the memorials that I have visited that I'm drawn to, most of those events are still ongoing. They might be ongoing in a different form, in maybe a less legible form, maybe in an even more legible form, more explicit form. But it makes me wonder, what is it exactly when we go to a memorial that we're memorializing, that we're remembering?
Thanks for being on the show today, Brandon.
Thank you, David. It's been really wonderful.
We are talking today to Brandon Shimoda, the author of The Grave on the Wall. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC. LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Again, that's Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Media Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater in Portland. The second son of Bob and Rita Marley, eight-time Grammy-winning musician and producer Stephen Marley, will perform in Portland with DJ Sasha Pena, who will be opening the show. Again, that's Stephen Marley, Babylon by Bus Tour on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. at the Roseland Theater, 8 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, World Beat Connection.
Feel them spirit.